Hi, and welcome to the Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew F. Pierce, and this podcast is edited in Boorloo, Western Australia. Sovereignty never ceded. Inner Violent Nature is one of the most gruesome and gory horror films of the year. It's also a film that Nadine Whitney has called a pure slasher death trip. Director Chris Nash takes audiences on the slasher ride of the year with his camera following the gnarly Johnny, played by Rye Barrett, as a silent brute slaughtering an array of college kids who possibly deserve their squishy demise. In the following interview, recorded ahead of the film's Australian release on the 1st of August 2024, Nadine discusses the film with director Chris Nash, delving into the dark delights that this horror offering has. As Nadine mentions in her review, the death trip that Nash takes his audience on shows a bevy of victims who will all face a gruesome demise. To find out more about the film, head over to thecurb.com.au to read Nadine's review, alongside other interviews and reviews. The Curb is a listener-supported platform, and to help keep us independent and ad-free, please head over to patreon.com/thecurb.au to support us from as little as $1 a month. For now, here is a snippet of the squishy trailer, followed by the interview with director Chris Nash.
Animals don't get too hung up on reason. They just keep killing.
Okay, so the first thing I wanted to ask you about is point of view. What you're doing in the film is really interesting in terms of where you put the camera. So we follow behind Johnny, we follow Johnny's point of view, and we follow a point of view that Johnny can't necessarily see. So there are things he can't see. So there's an omniscient character. Camera as well. Why, when you were deciding to use each aspect, what was the thing that made you go, okay, we're going to use this specific style for this specific scene?
There were, things we had to take into consideration were the rule set that we approached the film with, and then understanding those rules, what they did for the film, what they did for an audience watching the film, and then in that respect, when should we be allowed to break those rules? So our main rules were we need to have Johnny in every shot of the film. And whether that means we're just like picking up his feet, getting his hands, or whether or not the shot starts on him and then moves away, or whether the shot starts on something else and then he enters into the shot, we need to have him in every shot. So for instance, that was like a rule that was almost only in our service at some points. For instance, the campfire scene, it feels like we're breaking that form where we're not with Johnny anymore. But as the camera is moving around, Johnny's in the background of almost every single one of those shots. So even though the camera is closer to the audience, we're still serving that thesis of keeping Johnny in every frame that we can, or every shot that we can. But knowing when to break it, there were certainly some, like, artistic considerations that we had to keep in place. So, and technical. So we did break that rule, for instance, at moments during the yoga death, where we realized we needed to get some sort of reaction from the Aurora character and have, like, moments built into like her story where it would be like technically way too dangerous for us to try to frame, like, from the location we were shooting to try to frame both of them in. And so there was a point where, you know, on the day we're thinking like, the shot that we had in mind is not going to work out. Let's just like cut in and just get her and break those rules. And we know that we're not supposed to be breaking them. And that awareness in itself kind of gave us a permission to do it, being like, we're breaking the rules and we know we're not supposed to, but here's the reason why. And there are other times, like for instance, when we introduce, there's a standoff near the end between a ranger character and Johnny, where we just completely frame the ranger taking up the entire frame and then cut back to Johnny in the reverse position and trying to create a language. Whereas you're telling the audience, we've been with Johnny this entire time. And now suddenly we're just completely in view of this other character, and this other character is taking up the same size of frame as the character that we've been with the entire time, trying to convey this subconscious importance to the audience that this character is in the grand mythology of whatever's going on in this franchise that we're only watching this one movie of, that this character, this ranger character, is just as important. And then completely breaking from following Johnny at the end is just allowing us to, or showing the audience, I guess, what the film is actually about. And I don't want to go too much more into that. I don't really like talking about specifics about the meaning behind any film that I work on, but that,
well, you do have a character explaining at specific animal behaviors. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're treating Johnny as an animal the entire time. We don't want him to be an empathetic character. There's a moment of fleeting empathy in the film, and that's something that I consider an error on my part. I feel like I've had too many responses from audiences where they're like, where they tell me that, oh, they felt something for Johnny at that moment, and I feel like that's a complete misstep for me, where we may have gone too far into trying to create this empathetic moment where it was really just almost supposed to be a memory of a memory that he's having, that he doesn't quite know why he's compelled to
That's
to play with a keychain. But he's always just supposed to be a very unsympathetic force of nature that doesn't question himself and doesn't hesitate.
The parallels are kind of, you know, built into the whole Friday the 13th franchise. I don't think that anybody wouldn't see that. In that, you know, you've got the slow moving, preternaturally strong killer who you cannot get rid of. And whatever revenge aspect might have been there at the beginning, it's just irrelevant by the end. You know, he's just pure and unadulterated evil. And even having a character who in the film who played Vicky in one of the Friday the 13th films, I thought was a nice kind of crossover. So I think that when you just said we're watching an entry into a franchise where we're only seeing the one film, is that something that you were looking at with the whole notion of these kinds of Friday the 13th franchise, the franchise cinema, you know, that we have the legend, how the legend starts, how the legend progresses, the Crystal Lake that keeps going?
Yeah, for sure. When we were pitching the film, we were pitching it as, you know, what if Gus Van Sant directed a Friday the 13th sequel, or what if Gus Van Sant directed Friday the 13th part 6, something like that, just because there's so much, I mean, because we were aping, purposely trying to ape that Gus Van Sant style the entire time. But when I would have discussions with people about the Friday the 13th series, in general, or like Friday the 13th movies, it came, I started to realize that every entry is almost its own thing, and that the only connective tissue really throughout the series is the iconography, and just the weight that that iconography holds. And even then, the hockey mask killer didn't even come until like the third entry, which is really fascinating on its in itself.
It really is. And the third entry is the, is that the one that was meant to be in 3D?
Yep.
So the weakest of the lot.
Yeah.
Certainly in terms of the tits and ass value of the
Yeah.
Friday the
Yeah.
13th films.
Yeah, and that one especially, I think, suffered a lot under the censors too, as far as like gags and the gore. Yeah, but yeah, we did approach it as far as like being a sequel into a franchise, and what are the kind of tropes that sequels have too, like within these franchises that kind of evolve in a way where they reach a certain point where you're like, okay, when is this franchise going to die? And then it hits this other threshold of like, oh no, this is just going to go on forever. And even if they reboot it, these reboots are just going to be another entry into the franchise, and you can't ever escape the franchise of these films, and start anew. And that's where we wanted to live, somewhere right in the middle of that.
Yeah, I loved the meta-ness of it, and you know, the whole campfire tale thing is it is just such a standard trope that we know so well already that it was just it aligns at that very uncomfortable situation where you're actually laughing when people are dying horrifically. Which I really shouldn't have, but you know, there's just, I think it was Roger Ebert who said, you know, there are certain horror films that rely on characters acting stupidly to keep them going. And there are just so many characters in this film that act stupidly to keep it going. You know, throwing away the keys and that kind of stuff. It's just like, oh wow, you are so dead. And also with that particular character, it's like, when will you be dead? Like you're actually rooting for him to die.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's no real that, like, that was an interesting thing about the film too, and making it, knowing that we were like, there's not really going to be any suspense. It's going to be it can't be that kind of slasher film where, there's going to be jump scares, there's going to be suspense, it's going where you're going to be like, oh, when is this going to happen? We do create the those notions of when is this going to happen, but it hits you in a completely different way.
Yeah, well, I at first I was thinking, you know, does Johnny like really, is he picking on them in particular for what they've done or what they've said? And then I realized that he just isn't. Like it's just you're the first available, so you're the one I'm going for. You know, he's not making kind of judgment calls specifically on the characters. Although not to spoil it, but you know, there is a sense that the final girl might have been kind of let off to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, my impression of the film has always been that she gets away. She's done. She's like, she will be worried about him for the rest of her life, but she's safe from him.
Yeah, and she's also the one person who doesn't do a stupid thing. She's like, here's the thing you want, and I'm backing away now, and I'm running away. Like, here it is, I'm out of here. I'm not even going to try.
And directly in the face of what the ranger said, where he's like, you can't just give it back, and he's like, well, has anybody tried? Like, let's just do this. Let's just try it, see how it works.
So you're a Canuck, you're a Canadian. So we have something in common, in that we're not American, and we're from the colonies. So I like to think we have a fairly similar sense of humor. Was the humor deliberate, in the film?
Yeah, for sure. Like, even there were some like slapsticky moments that I thought were funny, and I thought, oh, this is gonna be funny. And then we like, even in shooting them, we're like, oh, is this funny? I don't know. Like, I laughed every time he threw the body into the display case. I'm like, oh, that's kind of funny. But even the yoga death in itself, like, that's just a grotesque banana peel joke to me. So like, it was all very deliberate. I'm just surprised that people are, laughing at the right moments, or at the moments that I planned.
I did laugh a lot. And it's like, yeah, I probably shouldn't. Oh, I can't help myself. Is this your first big feature?
Yeah, it's my first feature. I've just done short films and worked within the prosthetics industry up until now.
Which kind of comes through a lot in the practical effects in the film. So, how important are practical effects to you?
I really like them. I think that we're at an incredibly beneficial place with practical effects, where we have the effects that can aid practical effects, where so now we can do so much more. Like, now we don't have to worry about hiding rods and hiding, cables or anything like that, because we can just have VFX, work with a VFX team that can take all that out afterwards, and let practical effects breathe. I always enjoy them. I think being able to see something that is tangible, even if it's not as polished, but just the fact that there's like this squish factor to it, that an audience knows it's, even though it's fake, it's still real. And that leap over the uncanny valley does a lot of work, especially in genre filmmaking. I love practicals, and I think I always have, and I think it's I think it's really encouraging that it doesn't seem to be a dying art.
Not at all, not at all. Practical effects makes such a difference, I think. It just gives the film a texture and also allows you to have that kind of throwback effect. So, it looks like it could have been made in the 70s or the 80s, and it, even though it is very much contemporary, the conversations around the campfire, for example, with Aurora correcting people. I just really love the texture of the work. So when you were writing the film, what was the main thing you wanted audiences to get out of it?
This is gonna sound terrible, but I really didn't write with the audience in mind at all. We didn't have any ambition for this to get the kind of release that it's getting. We really assumed it would find a place on streaming, and an audience would find it. But But it was something that we wrote, and we like me and my producing partners, as we were working on it and just editing the script and figuring things out, it really was something that we were just writing with ourselves in mind, as far as, is this a film that we would like to see that we haven't seen before? But I think more people should write with that in mind, and risk the failure of it, because even if it, even if it doesn't work, like there are plenty of films that I've seen that in my mind I'm like, oh, I'm not a fan of this movie, but at the same time I'm a huge fan of it. Like, for instance, Skinamarink. Like, that's a movie that, I definitely don't love, but I love that it's out there, and I love that it exists, and I love that those big swings are being taken by filmmakers. And I'm completely like, I'm unfathomably interested in what his next film is going to be because of all of the risks that were taken with Skinamarink. And that was definitely a movie that was made with only the question of what will this movie look like? Like, what will the finished product elicit in me as the filmmaker? Like, you can tell that that was the only thing that he had in mind when he made it. So I think more filmmakers should operate on that, within that framework. But it's, clearly and understandably a risky thing to do.
Well, your risk paid off, and I congratulate you on the film. People are loving it, and I'm now going to have to go because I've seen the little
All right. Well,
button.
thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Nadine. I really, really enjoyed the questions.
Oh, you're welcome. And I look forward to the prequel, the sequel, all the next thing you do. Have a wonderful evening, Chris.
Thank you. You as well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Curb Podcast. In a Violent Nature lands in Australian cinemas from the 1st of August, which is tomorrow. Check your local cinema guides for screening details. For all other interviews and reviews, head over to thecurb.com.au. Thanks again. We'll see you on the next episode.